I'm Floyd Hall, and this is a Wonder Root artist feature. I have the pleasure today of talking with artist Durf Humphreys, one of our Wonder Root volunteers. Durf, how are you doing?
I'm doing pretty good. Thanks for having me, Floyd.
Durf, it's my pleasure. Let's get started from the beginning. You're from Atlanta.
Yes.
And you've been on a pretty interesting journey ever since you left high school.
That's true.
So
a bit of the world.
Let's talk about the places where you've lived, what you've seen, and what you've done.
Well, I went to college in Massachusetts, which was a bit different than most of my life that I'd spent in the South. It's as much of a foreign nation as some of the other foreign nations I visited. While I was in college, I went and I lived in Turkey for a while. When I finished school, I went and went to Ireland, which was also an exciting place to live, even though they speak the same language as us. Still definitely a different culture. And I got to live in Providence, Rhode Island. I've lived in Atlanta again. I got to stay here and went to school at Georgia State, where I got my master's. And then after that, I spent 5 years in China.
So let's talk about the China part of your journey and then beyond. But you mentioned before we got into this conversation that you got a chance to see some really great things, interesting things during your time in China. What were some of the landmark moments that you got a chance to live through when you were there?
Of things that I remember sort of most clearly that really stood out, experiencing the 2008 earthquake in Sichuan was something I'd never experienced before. We don't have a lot of earthquakes here in Georgia. And when the earthquake had happened, it happened at 2:30, right as I was beginning to teach a class. And living in Western China, which is not a lot of the China that you see on TV, this is the part of China that's still very much developing. The plumbing in a lot of those buildings baffled me. Sometimes you flush a toilet and a room would shake. So when the earthquake started, I thought, oh, maybe this is just some plumbing problem. And all my students, they take out their dictionaries and they're going through it very, very fast because they haven't learned the word earthquake in English yet. Sort of all my students in unison say, oh, we have an earthquake. I didn't know what to do. So I think we're supposed to stand inside the arches of the doors. That's what I'd seen on TV. But I have 100 students. There's no way we're all going to fit in there. So they said we should go outside. I thought that's a good idea. Later I learned since the buildings in China are made out of concrete, if we had stayed in the doorway and the buildings had collapsed, it's the worst place to be. And then Sichuan Province is a lot like Atlanta in the sense that, one, it's the same latitude as Atlanta. And the people there are really laid back. They like to drink beer outside very much, which I think is a hallmark of Atlanta. So when the earthquake happened in Sichuan, what most Sichuan people did, they said, oh, it's too dangerous to stay inside because the houses might collapse. We're all going to go out to the park. We're going to go out to the river, far away from tall buildings, stay up all night, gamble, drink beer, laugh with our friends. And that was a really interesting time to be there, especially having come from the United States coming from Georgia, having seen Katrina and what it had done to Louisiana and the influx of people from Katrina that had come to the United States and seeing how China handled a major disaster. And just seeing how differently China handled it and the United States handled it, that was a good learning experience. And having the Olympics there as well was something else. And befriending the Muslim community there was something that I didn't expect, that they would be interested in foreigners because we're not Han Chinese, and they would be certainly welcoming. And when they would find out about my Jewish heritage, there's not many places in the world where, you know, a Muslim is excited to see a Jew. That's not really the picture that's painted for us of Muslims abroad. But they're so excited because the Han Chinese don't come from the Abrahamic religions. So they see you as a Jew. They think of you as, oh, yeah, you know, we all worship the same God. That was, you know, something that I just didn't expect when I would go over there. A lot of things. Everything that I thought about China was pretty much wrong. And it's interesting to hear my fellow Americans say things about China. It's like, I remember once when I was as misguided and misinformed as some of our countrymen.
You were teaching in China, and you were part of the Peace Corps.
Yes.
So talk about, I guess, how you got to China and kind of give some context to what you were there for and how that may have been a springboard to the next phase of your life.
When I was finishing my master's degree, I decided I really wanted to go see the world. I'd been studying the history of the world, particularly Africa, and I wanted to go to different parts of it. I was particularly excited about the idea of doing my service in Benin because their Independence Day is the same day as my birthday. And I thought, oh, that would be great. There'll be a big party on my birthday every year that I'm there. And it was just about 3 weeks before I was intended to go to some country in Africa. They hadn't given me my assignment. They said it was a French-speaking country in Africa. And they called me up and they said, well, what do you think about going to Asia? Because I had the master's degree. I said, okay. They didn't tell me what country, but I was able to figure out from the programs. They weren't going to send me to Mongolia. You didn't need a master's degree for those kind of programs there, or the program in Laos. The program in Thailand, excuse me. They don't have a program in Laos yet. And so I realized it was China, and I never pictured myself living in China. So when they said this, I said, well, I really want to get out of the United States. China is nothing to laugh at. I mean, it's certainly a significant country in the world. I'll give it a try. And it was really moments of being in China that I realized it was really a great place for me. One, the women were incredibly beautiful. The food was very, very spicy. Everybody was so friendly. There's no guns there. There's all these things like, I really would just, all these kind of perks and wonderful things about China I hadn't expected. I pictured this sort of a very Maoist regime. Everyone was going to wear like the Sun Yat-sen suits and be very serious, but found that the sense of humor of the Chinese people complemented my own very well. And they really loved eating, and so do I. With the Peace Corps, it's nice. They give you a lot of language training. You get to live with a Chinese family, and then you have certain opportunities that the average foreign teacher doesn't have. I got to meet the U.S. ambassador to China. I got to meet Condoleezza Rice, and I was trained pretty well to do the job that I did, especially meeting other foreign teachers who were not as well-equipped, hadn't been given the same kind of cultural training, language training, and also jobs for teaching English and cultural studies in China. And the school that I first taught at was a medical college, North Sichuan Medical University. And the way that the Chinese education program works, you choose what college you want to go to, and you put that on their Gaokao, which is kind of like our SATs. And the government decides, based on your score, what college you're going to go to and what your major will be. Which may sound very frightful to Americans to think, oh no, I want to go to college and study French poetry and have it be my choice. But when you get out of school here and you majored in French poetry, there's no job for you because we don't need people who are experts in French poetry. So China's planned economy, one of the perks is they try and create people to fill jobs that will actually exist when they graduate. But all my students that had chosen to go to the medical college and ended up being English majors, you can see how that wasn't really their plan. You don't go to medical school. It's like going to Georgia Tech for, I guess anything you go to Georgia Tech is still pretty good. But, you know, for a non-engineering degree at Georgia Tech, it's something similar to that. So those students were pretty disappointed to end up teaching English or studying English rather than their medical degrees. I also got to teach some doctors and some nurses as a continuing education program there. Taught rural high school and middle school teachers some teaching methods. Did some fundraising for the earthquake. A lot of different things I got to do in Peace Corps. And Peace Corps puts this mindset on you that you have a job, but you always need secondary projects. You always need to be doing something more. And then also, as a Peace Corps volunteer, you're a diplomat wherever you go. You're sort of serving, not necessarily the interests of the American government, but what you feel like is your patriotic sense of, I want to represent America well. One of my motivations in going into the Peace Corps was the 8 years prior, during the Bush administration, I felt that my America was not being represented abroad, and that maybe I could go do some nice things and people might forget about some negative foreign policy decisions that had been made. And when I finished my Peace Corps service, I hadn't learned Chinese very well. I still had many questions about China. It's a huge country. So much of it I hadn't seen. And I'd met a very wonderful woman who would later become my wife. So I decided to stay in China for the additional 3 years. As I moved to other places, I got more autonomy, having more experience, having taught in universities. In my final school, I was able to teach a graduate seminar in the history of Islam, which I'm pretty sure I'm one of the very few people who have ever taught a history of Islam to Chinese graduate students, and much less a foreigner. I also got to create a class called The History of Superheroes, which is a class, 150 student lecture class. I don't think anyone's ever taught history of superheroes in China. To be the only one, that's pretty nice. I got to teach 20th century American history there. which is so exciting to see the students of a country that was depicted as an enemy for so long, and to have a dialogue about what the United States is, and for them to hear some of my criticisms of the United States really, you know, broke the ice quite well. Like when they hear my criticism of the film Avatar, many students really latched on to this as a symbol that, you know, I wasn't like other Americans. And I'd tell them, you know, a lot of Americans are like me. You know, we don't all, we're not all George Bush. We're not all these kind of action heroes that you see on TV. Of the things that my students had seen on TV, they're most curious about in America. One was guns. My boy students, two things boys would always ask about. One is the girls in rap videos, and the other ones are guns, because just really things that they just didn't have in China at all. The dancing in China is very different than dancing in the United States. And then the guns, you have people who are just kind of, they'll be experts on guns. I would meet guys and they would tell me all about the AK-47 and all these other weapons. They never touched a gun. They'd never really seen one in real life besides soldiers carrying them. But they were absolute experts, much more so than me, who'd grown up in a gun culture. Or experts on cars, and they'd never driven a car before. But they would tell me how much all these different cars cost in China, costs in the United States, costs in Europe, when they were never going to own any of these cars. But they're quite obsessed with it. I really enjoyed China. I enjoyed being able to meet the people I did and do the job that I did there.
I'm sure you were creating all this time, or maybe this time was continuing to add to your art perspective. So what did you create during this time?
Before I went to China, I gave away all of my musical instruments, which included a lot of keyboards that I'd done some circuit bending on, several banjos, guitars. And when I went to China, I had my computer, and I had a great amount of music acquired through various means. And so I decided I was just going to do a lot of mashups. But the mashups that I did are much different than like Girl Talk or Go Home Productions, because I would make the things that I were sampling, I tried to have some kind of political or social message in it. A lot of beats I made out of, say, the Dalai Lama laughing, or, you know, I'm sampling Slavo Zizek, you know, instead of just many different things that I was putting into it. A lot of just strange music. And then also I was given the opportunity to DJ lots of times, different places there, and to play music, just acoustic guitar. They would ask, you know, play some classic American songs, often Hotel California, which I would refuse to play. But Country Roads is a big popular one there. Here's the interesting thing about China. There are two American songs that almost every Chinese person knows. One of them is Yesterday Once More by the Carpenters, and the other one is Country Roads by John Denver. Because when Deng Xiaoping first came to the United States in, I think, 1978, the two most popular songs during that week on the American radio were Country Roads and Yesterday Once More. So when he came back to China, he told everyone, these are the quintessential American songs. Most Americans don't know the Carpenters number, the Yesterday Once More. And if you listen to the words of it, it's like, when I was young, I used to listen to the radio, and it's a very nostalgic song about sort of 1950s doo-wop music, which the Chinese people absolutely did not experience. In the 1950s, their songs are all, you know, Chairman Mao is brighter than the sun, the workers, you know, work unitedly and have a paradise later on. So I got to play a bit of music there. And when I first arrived, a gentleman named Zhang Hao, who contacted me, found my music page on MySpace, and he said, "Oh, you're from China. You're, you know, I really like your music. It's really weird." And I said, "Oh, I'm not from China. I just moved here." And we had been sort of internet friends for 3 years. And when I got married, part of my honeymoon, went up to the city where this guy lived, Zhang Hao, and I met him for the first time. And we did some more traveling throughout China and Mongolia. And then a year later, Zhang Hao said, "Yeah, you should really move to Dalian." I got to move there and spent a lot of time with him. And I worked with Yudong, who is another guitarist in this band called Doc Tok Shok, which is becoming one of the biggest bands in China. Their last record was produced by PK-14, or the singer from PK-14, which is a big rock band in China. If you know, like, Karsic Cars, sort of the same sort of family of groups, Wang Wen. And it's a really, really great band. And I got to sort of be intimate with them, write several of their lyrics, because they sing songs in English. And in Dalian, the musician community was much cooler than the musician community that I was in part of in the rest of China. And then now the way that China continues to influence my art is that I'm drawing a lot of pandas. And they continue to be a kind of a symbol that reoccurring in my art.
Talk about your comic, if you can.
Okay. Right now I'm working on a comic with my friend Damon Hooks. And it tells the story of a world where there's sort of these panda humanoids that are sort of deities. They're in a dimension that's higher than our own universe. And it's unlike heaven as it's depicted in religious books. It's much more bureaucratic. And so there are two worlds in this heaven, or two kind of world systems. One are the civilized folks who have their ID and go to their 9-to-5 jobs. And the other group is the wild, and these are feral people, people who do not want to go along with the system. So it's kind of clash of the titans, civilized god versus wild god. And of course, the civilized gods have that kind of American beauty evil already seeped into them. You know, they love child prostitutes, they love drugs, they love corruption in any way, shape, or form. One thing that they like to do is have gladiator fights, you know, sort of dog fights with human beings, people from our dimension. And the story kind of deals with this sort of underground human trafficking that the gods are doing, and the gods happen to be pandas.
So, Dirk, with all of that being said, you had a film that was in the Atlanta Film Festival on the 1906 race riot. Where did that come from? Where does this film fit in your art making, in your art perspective, or does this lean more towards your education in terms of your focus on history?
One of the great things about our lifetime is the democratization of technology, and that it's been easier for us to make movies now than at any other time. And as soon as that technology became available to me, I started to play around with it. When I went to Georgia State, Campus Movie Fest had just started. It was a program out of Emory. And they wanted documentary films, and the Association of Georgia State University Historians thought they could make a movie. And it was the 100-year anniversary, 2006, of the 1906 race riot. And several historians there were experts on this. You know, they live in pretty much where the riot happened. And they Cliff Coon did walking tours to show people sort of what had gone on. And so many historians thought this would be a great idea for a movie, and a timely one. When I joined this, I was quite intimidated. Most people, when you go to graduate school, your first year, you feel like an idiot because all these people have read all these books that you haven't read. But what I realized was that none of these people had any idea how to make a movie. So all of their great historian skills were wonderful, but it was not going to be able to put a movie together. So it was really quite fortunate for the project that I arrived, and really fortunate for me because I suddenly felt like there was a place for me in academia where I could be at least a little bit better than somebody else because there's so many intimidating scholars, you know, when you have this kind of fierce discourse. And then the following year after that, I made another documentary with Agsu about the homelessness in Atlanta, which I don't think was as good as the original one. There's a lot of great energy in the first documentary that we made together. And I like making films. The sort of artsy films that I made have mostly been stop-motion films, making lots of different puppets out of garbage. And then lots of different artists in Atlanta and around the world have sent me puppets to make films with. If you're familiar with the great graffiti artist and tattoo artist here in Atlanta, Sam Parker, lots of murals that you'll see around the city he's done. He made a lot of really beautiful puppets in my movies. Anyone that's ever seen any of my stop-motion films, they would see them and go, oh, that one puppet is really outstanding. It's almost always Sam Parker. Making movies, I don't see why the documentary would necessarily be outside of my artistic craft, but I would say that I have higher standards. If I'm going to try to pass something off as academic, it's okay to be kind of loose with your rules and reality when you're making art, but some things are too important to let art take priority over accuracy.
What are you making right now?
besides the comic that I'm working on. I'm drawing a lot of pictures of different buildings in Atlanta. These are kind of commissioned pieces, people's homes and people's churches. I just finished a series of 12 pictures of Super Mario villains in pinup poses. It's very mature. You can check out many of my drawings. I have a blog. It's WayneShowLong .wordpress.com. It's probably difficult for many of you to spell. The first part is Wayne, which is the last name of Batman. Then the next word is Xiao, X-I-A-O, which means small in Chinese. And then Long, L-O-N-G, which means dragon in Chinese. Li Xiaolong is the Mandarin name of a big Chinese martial arts guy named Bruce Lee. So if you take Bruce Lee and Bruce Wayne and put them together, Wayne Xiaolong, that's where the name of my blog comes from. And I do a lot of different interviews with people in the comic book industry, and then also I exhibit a lot of my art there. And then I review some things in comic books. But yeah, mostly that's what I'm keeping up with right now.
In all of your travels, Durf, what's it been like to fit in all of these different cultures and different communities? What's that been like for you?
I always felt like a weirdo in America, as it was. So living in a community that is distinctly not your community is kind of a relief. You know, yeah, of course I'm a weirdo. My relationship with my wife is fantastic because, you know, if there's anything where, like, we start to have a fight, both of us, this is a cultural difference. That's what it is. We'll just blame it on the fact that you're Chinese and I'm American, and it's not really that you did anything wrong or I did anything wrong, just cultural difference. And when working with people from other cultures, sometimes they might ask me something to do something where I wouldn't take that from an American boss, but it's a little easier to have your boss yell at you when they're from another culture because you just kind of feel like, okay, this is this culture's rules. I'm going to play by their rules because I'm a guest here. Being a guest is a really liberating experience sometimes because you know how you're supposed to act, kind of. You know that when you act weird, they find it humorous and funny and endearing. And when you have your personality, sometimes your strange personality represents America to them, and you kind of want to, you know, clear that up. But I like being kind of a strange person. Not being a minority anymore coming back to the United States felt very weird. Also, not being the tallest person anymore suddenly felt very intimidating. Walking around China, I never felt like I was going to get robbed because I always had a good 6 inches on everybody. Then come back to Atlanta where, you know, we have mountains of human beings here. Huge folks. I always would say when you go from Sichuan, which has notoriously small people in China, you'll go from western China to eastern China, and you can definitely see the people have gotten bigger. And then you'll fly to maybe to Japan, and the people in Japan are significantly bigger than the people in eastern China. And then by the time that you get to America, you might land in California or Seattle or New York, a little bit bigger. And then I come back to Atlanta, and it's just like we just have some enormous people here. It's just like getting bigger and bigger and bigger, like they're getting pumped up. And then also, you know, hosting people from China and the United States, hosting my wife, it's so much more fun to kind of walk around your own hometown and say, oh, this is something interesting. You never heard of the Rocky Horror Picture Show. Every other American's kind of bored with it. But to someone that's never seen it, like, this is a really weird thing that you might want to check out. So, I like being a minority, especially when you're a welcome minority. And in China, foreigners are incredibly welcome. I don't think that I would have received the same sort of embrace from the community having traveling to other countries.
Durf Humphreys. Durf, give the name of your blog one more time for our listeners out there.
Okay, it's WayneXiaolong.wordpress.com. WayneXiaolong.wordpress.com.
Durf, thank you for your time. I enjoyed it.
Ah, thanks.